Hi, and welcome to Intern Ready OBGYN, a podcast aimed at helping you excel during your intern year in OBGYN. My name is Dr. Lucy Brown. I'm a resident at Johns Hopkins and your host for Intern Ready OBGYN.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Lucy Brown, and I'm joined today by Dr. Jennifer Dory for our first episode of Intern Ready, our intern survival guide to your first year of OBGYN residency. So I do want to just preface this by saying that everybody has their own style. Your program may teach you something different and different survival guide techniques. These are just things that I learned when I was an intern, and I hope they can be at least a starting point for your first few months.
All right. Welcome, everybody. So the first thing we're going to jump into talking about is sort of how do you globally view and approach this brand new job? So you've just graduated medical school. You are now an official doctor. You are now stepping into the role as clinician and being people's actual doctor. So how do you view this new job as an intern?
Yeah. And I think that was a question that I had at the beginning of the year too, because you get probably an intern orientation, but each rotation is so different. But the first thing I want to say is you are not expected to know everything on your first day. What you are expected to do in your job is to be open to feedback as much as possible, have a good attitude in terms of like labor delivery. You're likely managing multiple patients in triage. So being able to multitask is really important and be able to like organize multiple patients all at once. Set expectations early on, either with your chiefs or with your attendings. Have them like tell you what the expectations are for each block. By the end of the block, what should I be good at? Like, what am I expected to know? You're not going to get like a standardized orientation before each rotation. And so it's good to kind of go in with a set of goals that you can hopefully achieve by the end of the block. And even with each like surgery, you can go in with expectation setting with your attending and say, by the end of this block, my goal is to be able to place a port, or my goal is to be able to navigate the laparoscopic camera. And then they can also help you to achieve that goal by the end if you set that expectation early on. And then the last thing as part of your job is to ask for help when you need it. And if you're worried about a patient, make sure you escalate early. It's better to overreact, especially early on, than to underreact.
Totally agree with all of those. I think so important to kind of know what you know, but also be very aware of what you don't yet know. And lean into those strengths, but also be aware of what you still have yet to learn so that you're asking for help when you need it. All right, let's get into a little bit of specifics about some specific places or locations or services that you'll probably get on your intern year. So let's talk about when you're actually your first couple days or your first block on labor and delivery, what you should come into it having looked at ahead of time, what you should be trying to focus on learning and solidifying early on, and how you kind of think people excel on their first block on labor and delivery.
Yeah. So let's say like it's night before your first shift on labor delivery, which is totally terrifying. I remember being so, so nervous before my first block. First thing you can do if you want to kind of prepare is look up kind of what are the fetal heart tracings, how to interpret decelerations, how to interpret what is a reactive like non-stress test, because that's going to be the bread and butter of labor delivery. Being able to differentiate category 1, 2, and 3 tracings, starting off with that. And then during the actual shift, you're going to be starting to learn how to do cervical exams, which is the digital exam to determine how dilated a patient is in their labor course. And everybody is bad at this at first. Everybody is bad at it. We at my program require a back check for the first 6 months because the expectation is that you're going to be bad at it. And the only way to learn it is to do many of them. And so it's okay if you don't know what the exam is the first time. But what I would always do is kind of describe what I was feeling to my senior when they were in the room. And sometimes they would help me navigate like, oh, it's actually really, really posterior. So you just have to keep going. Or you go over this like, oh, she has a Nabothian cyst here. And then also on labor delivery, there's a lot of documentation. So making sure you kind of stay on top of that and get into good habits of documenting every time you go in a patient room, every time you do a cervical check, every time you respond to a tracing, like a deceleration in a room, make sure you write it doesn't have to be extensive, but just writing a quick note for it. Because it's important like to be able to look back and see what happened to this patient's labor course later on. Something else that you'll be expected to manage early on in your intern year is patients on magnesium, either for preeclampsia with severe features or preterm labor patients who are before 32 weeks, and knowing the signs of magnesium toxicity. So when you go in a room asking the general preeclampsia symptom questions, you have a headache, vision changes, chest pain, shortness of breath, right upper quadrant pain, and then going into your physical exam, you're going to listen to their heart and lungs. You want to make sure you're listening for crackles because they can get some fluid overload, and then checking their reflexes. Typically, if somebody is magnesium toxic, they're going to have decreased reflexes. So keeping an eye out for that and knowing what their baseline reflexes are early on. Like some people just have plus one reflexes. So recognizing when there's a change in that. And knowing that if you are worried about magnesium toxicity, to go ahead and order a magnesium level. Some programs, I think, do just routinely get magnesium levels as a form of their mag checks. My program does not do this. Like you have to initiate ordering the magnesium level. And if it is elevated, like over what we would anticipate for people on magnesium, then you do want to give that calcium gluconate, which is the function of that is it's like a bivalent cation and it displaces magnesium, which is another bivalent cation. So it kind of cleanses the receptor so that you reduce the symptoms of toxicity, because mag toxicity, it's essentially a depressive agent. It depresses your respiratory rate, depresses your heart rate. So you want to be really careful about magnesium.
What's the easiest way to remember that reference range? I was always taught roughly 4.8 to 8.4, and it keeps it really easy. Just you flip the numbers, 4.8 to 8.4. Outside of those ranges, you should probably be reevaluating.
Okay. The last thing that every intern is going to be expected to manage are vaginal deliveries. And with vaginal deliveries comes postpartum hemorrhage. You're going to be managing postpartum hemorrhages as an intern very early on. So knowing what medications to use and what contraindications there are. So just as a refresher, Hemabate or Carboprost, you do not want to use in patients with asthma, any kind of asthma. It's very hard to reverse the symptoms of Hemabate on the respiratory system. So you do have to be careful with that. The second medication that we use very commonly is Methergen. And that one, you want to be careful about using it with patients with hypertension, preeclampsia, gestational hypertension. Sometimes you can get away with using it if they have only had a couple of like elevated blood pressures, but especially you don't want to use it in folks who have severe preeclampsia or blood pressures like that hang out in the 160s. And then Misoprostol, there are very few contraindications. Some people have allergies to Misoprostol, but that's super rare. One side effect that you just want to be aware of is that folks can have like a fever after getting Misoprostol. So just knowing to anticipate that after you give it. Say, you know, going down the line, you're probably using the other ones first, and then you get to TXA, which is a thrombotic agent to help like clot the blood when you're hemorrhaging. So things that are conditions that are contraindicated with TXA are folks with a history of blood clot, PE, DVT. So you want to be really careful with that. And those are the big ones.
Yep. And then everybody's getting PIT.
Yeah, everybody's getting
PIT. And then actually, I guess the other thing you can ask for is for your PIT wide open.
Yes, you can ask for your PIT wide open. You can do your bimanual massage. And then definitely, if you haven't already, make sure you call your senior in.
So if you get to that point where the placenta came out, everything was looking good, your attending walked away, and things start to audibly drip on the floor, first thing you're probably thinking is, let me call for some help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And trying to keep track of how much blood you've actually lost. Hopefully you have a bag underneath the patient's bottom, because it happens very quickly and you may reach 1 liter in like 5 minutes or less, and make sure that if you reach that point, you may need to be going to the OR, you may need to be calling for blood, you may need to be calling for anesthesia. And the golden rule kind of in summary of all of this is that if you're thinking, should I call somebody for help, call them. Things can go from fine to bad very, very quickly on OB.
Okay, so let's change gears then and say, you know, your OB block has come and gone. It's time for you to begin on gynecology. And this may be, you know, probably is going to start with benign gynecology. We'll start there. So Dr. Brown, how are you thinking about approaching your benign GYN block? What are your usual sort of tasks that you're thinking you're going to need to be prepared for? And how are you preparing for those things.
Yeah. And it obviously depends on where you are, but at my program, your role is surrounding on the post-op patients is one of the first roles that you'll do at the start of your day. And if somebody had a surgery the day before, you're going to be seeing them. So knowing what questions to ask and what a normal post-op recovery would be. You're also likely going to be seeing consults in the ED. And so having an algorithm for how to see your first consult in the ED. And we do have a podcast on that coming up as well. And then you'll also often be in a lot of minor GYN cases, hysteroscopy most commonly, leaps, cones. Having kind of an understanding of what goes into hysteroscopy, when to be worried about like fluid overload for cones, like how to place your stay sutures, et cetera. So like those are things to definitely look up ahead of time. Make sure you're looking up your cases the night before so that you know your patient very, very well. In terms of consults in the ED, the most common things you're going to be consulted for are AUB, like abnormal uterine bleeding, and kind of making sure you know the workup based on the patient's age. Are they premenopausal, they're postmenopausal? And then what's their hemoglobin? Should you be giving this patient blood? Should you be admitting them for a blood transfusion? Should you be starting them on some kind of medication like Provera to help kind of reset their endometrial lining? The second most common, and I'm not necessarily second most common, but another very common consult that we get is pregnancy of unknown location, and then when to be concerned about an ectopic pregnancy. So always looking at your concerning beta HCG values. At what point should you be seeing a gestational sac? That's called the discriminatory zone. And you should be seeing a gestational sac by the time that beta HCG is like 3,500. Some literature will say like 4,000, but if you're beta HCG is like higher than that, you need to be concerned if you're not seeing anything
in the uterus. The one exception being multiples. So if somebody also has a reason to potentially have multiples, that was a Clomid pregnancy, something like that, then multiples will often have a higher discriminatory zone, but they should usually also rise faster.
Another very common consult that you're going to get is, it's always going to be like rule out ovarian torsion, which is very like almost impossible to like officially rule out anything, but you can like evaluate a patient and say you have a low concern for an ovarian torsion. Ovaries can actually intermittently torse on itself. And so if somebody has a reason to have a torsed ovary, such as a cyst, typically a cyst that is like 4 to 8 centimeters is that like sweet spot range to have a cyst that torses the ovary. Anything smaller is not going to have like the weight to torse it. And anything bigger is going to be a bit more fixed and it's going to be harder to torse in the torse around the ovary. Factoids, typically the right side is going to torse more often than the left side because the sigmoid colon is protective on the left side against torsions. So something to look out for if somebody has sharp pain on the right side of their tender to palpation. If they have vomiting or nausea, oftentimes that's a really strong sign for ovarian torsion. And then especially if they have some kind of cyst. And then the other thing you want to make sure you're looking at. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. With the torsion ladies, they will be truly peritonitic. So the other thing you're really looking for is the peritonitis. So a lot of us will do the hip check, which is you mosey up to their bed, you introduce yourself, and you lightly hip check the bed. If the jiggle of the bed makes them wince, that's a very overt sign of peritonitis. If not, you can do an actual abdominal exam. But if you wince when I hip check the bed, we need to go to the OR. That's sort of that's a kind of from the door 30 seconds evaluation. I'm like, nope, we're going to the OR. I'm just going to start putting in orders while I'm finishing up this conversation with you.
Yeah, no, that's a good tip. And then making sure you look at the ultrasound because the ultrasound itself cannot officially rule out torsion. Somebody can have Doppler flow to their ovaries, even when they have like an intermittent torsion. But when you don't have flow, that's pretty indicative that you need to be going to the OR to detorse. One of the last things you're going to be seeing in the ED for consults is post-op fever. One of your post-op patients may have come back to the ED with a fever. So knowing what the differential is, especially based on timing. So post-op day 1 versus post-op day 7 and up. So you're thinking your wind early on. So that's like atelectasis, water. That's when you're thinking about a UTI. That's typically post-op 3 to 5. Walking. And that's when you're worried about like a DVT or a PE. Those can actually cause fevers. And that's typically later, like 4 to 6 days post-op. Wound, worried about infection. So that's typically later, like post-op 5 to 7, because it takes some time for an infection to develop. And then last one is wonder drugs. So drugs themselves can cause fever, and that can be at any point during the post-op course.
And is there a golden rule for GYN?
If somebody has abdominal pain and a uterus, get a pregnancy test, always. And the ED should be doing this, but you never know.
The ED is really good at it, but I will say as a gynecologist, it's a silly thing to miss.
Yes.
So that goes for your office visits too and things.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk a little bit more about sort of life and balancing that. And how do you do all of these things, taking on this new role as a doctor, like being responsible and dealing with that pressure of responsibility of these new of being people's doctor, and knowing there's so much yet to know, and not burning out, like not being overwhelmed by it all the time? How do you balance some of those things?
Yeah, it's really hard. And it's different than med school, where you have like dedicated study time. And you don't have as many kind of patient responsibilities in med school. So you just don't have time to read an entire textbook or textbook chapters. Or at least I didn't. If that's something that like that you feel like you learn well from, like reading a textbook chapter, that's great. For me, it didn't really work. So rather than trying to read like TLINs or just big textbooks, I would read about my patients, because then I have that like direct learning experience where I'm learning about something and then I'm applying it to a patient and reviewing all of your bad outcomes, because we're ultimately going to have bad outcomes even early on in intern year, and making sure you learn from every one of them. So you'll also like come across learning points throughout your intern year, and keep track of that in your phone, little learning points, gems, things that your attendings tell you, things that your chiefs tell you, keep track of that in your phone somewhere. I have a folder on my laptop that is like diagrams, notes that I've come across throughout my 3 years so far of things that I often forget, and then having a list of quick resources to look things up, like UpToDate, ACOG, Open Evidence, just to make sure you have access to quick resources, easy access.
I will add to that and say, yeah, I think I made a folder in my photos that I really liked, that was like a lot of like key points and important slides from Grand Rounds or M&M that had a lot of like tables that other people had made for me with like really good sort of high density information, and use that as some of my study material. I also really embraced the phrase trust but verify. Mm-hmm. So whenever I learned something new from one of my attendings, from one of my co-residents, from whoever, I would write it down. I would write down the essentially gist of it. And then I would go back and find the source material when I was on a rotation that let me do it. Quite frankly, this happened a lot of the times on my nights rotations, because you have a little bit more flexibility with your time on nights if you use it wisely. And so I kept lists of things to go back and look up. And that's when I would read my Sentinel papers. And that's when I would read, you know, the Magpie trial in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Or the term prom trial. Are these things that really shaped some of our practice models?
Yeah.
And from there, branch out and read new things. But it was a trust but verify. I wanted to take people at their word, but also I wasn't letting myself off the hook on reading the original source material. And I will say the same thing now goes for everybody using Open Evidence. So Open Evidence is great in a pinch, but make yourself a list and get good at reading the source material as well. Because if you can't interpret a trial, your knowledge is going to be already limited. So learning how to really interpret the trials, it's helpful for practicing medicine. It is helpful for your CREOGs. It is helpful for your boards. It is helpful for all of our standardized things, but it's also just helpful for being an up-to-date good physician. And when you are done with your boards and things and doing your maintenance of certification, that's literally all I do for my maintenance of certification is read papers, interpret them, and prove that I can still do that, because it's that important to the ongoing practice of medicine. It's intimidating. You won't have a lot of time for your intern year, but if you make a robust list, you will have plenty of reading material for your second year. And that's honestly second year nights were where I did a lot of my reading and my video work. That was, I think, really helpful to have. I watched a lot of shows. We all do in the middle of the night. It's fine. But you can also intermix that with other things.
That's really good advice.
All right, let's talk about the operating room. It is both, in my mind, the happiest place, and as an intern, one of the scariest places, because you just don't know, like, your job and your role yet, and, like, you so badly are ready and excited to be the surgeon, but, like, am I really a surgeon? I'm just an intern. So how do you prep for the OR? How do you start off on the right foot with not only your attendings, but the OR staff and everybody there that's going to play a huge role in how successful you are your first year in the OR?
And all four of your years, honestly. You make a good impression early on. That's very important. So you're going into the OR and you are absolutely not expected to know how to do surgery or how to do the case. But what you are expected to know is why this patient is getting surgery and that patient's kind of background info, because those are things you can read up on in advance. So know that pretty like stone cold prior to entering the operating room. So you want to know what prior surgeries they have, because that's important if they have adhesive disease and how you're going to enter. What kind of chronic medical conditions do they have? And then what's like their starting hemoglobin? Those are all things that can actually change the way you're going to proceed with surgery. The other thing that you'll want to know early on is positioning, patient positioning. There are a lot of nerve injuries that can actually happen during surgery, especially like in your hips, in your knees, in the nerves in those regions. So knowing how to position a patient properly in that dorsal lithotomy position is really, really important. And it seems like not relevant to the surgery itself, but you could do the best hysterectomy ever and cure patients like take out all their fibroids and their pelvic pain is completely gone, but then they have like femoral nerve injury. So, and that is lifelong. So you have to be so, so, so careful with nerve injuries. As you go along and you're seeing surgeries multiple times, you can start trying to think about what are the next steps, like predicting and anticipating what the next steps are in the case. And that way you're like, that's like some active learning that you can be doing rather than just standing and retracting. And early on, again, you're most likely to going to be in those minor cases, and that's where you can really develop your surgical skills. But you're also going to be put in cases like major debulks for gyn-onc, big X-labs that you're probably not going to be doing very much, and you're not going to be able to shine surgically, and that's okay. But what is really valuable to a team is that you can do kind of the logistical things, the administrative things around the surgery, meaning like making sure the patient is consented, making sure their post-op orders are in or their discharge orders are in before leaving the PACU, because that is a really helpful way to be part of a team, even when you're not necessarily doing like the surgery itself.
And then figuring out, you know, talking with your chief and figuring out the cases where you do get to surgically shine on your benign gyn, as Dr. Brown said, this will probably be your hysteroscopies. So coming to that hysteroscopy prepared to do well. And that usually, at least in my mind, means having seen them, practice them, and kind of knowing all your steps. If you can step into that surgical seat and kind of take over and have smooth movements and know what you're doing, I'm going to let you do more. If you can tell me all the things you're doing, I'm going to let you do more. So figuring out your resources for how to prep. I am a visual person. I'm a visual learner, especially for procedural things, despite the fact that I run a podcast. Haha, it's audio, or audio, but still. I really like AAGL. So AAGL is the MIGS Association, but the gynecologic laparoscopists. And it has a wonderful website called SurgeryU. This is one of my favorite resources for young surgeons, GYN surgeons. They have beautiful videos and tutorials from some of the best surgeons across the country and internationally that'll walk you through surgeries. Everything from a basic hysteroscopy to a more involved hysteroscopic myomectomy to a bilateral salpingectomy to the most difficult 3,500 gram robotic hysterectomies you've ever seen, and everything in between. This was a platform that I used. It didn't exist when I was an intern, but I used a lot as an upper level resident, and quite frankly, still watch today when I'm prepping for harder cases. But it'll walk you through how to do those surgeries ahead of time, so you know how to, you know, what instruments you have an option to use, you know, the different steps. And some of them will even walk you through the tubing and for like the hysteroscopies, some of the, putting your scope together and like putting together your tubing can be intimidating as an intern. So it walks you through a lot of that stuff. If you know you're going to go do a NovaSure ablation, there's probably not great videos on that a lot of places, but guess what? those reps sure do have good videos. So yeah. Just Google NovaSure ablation and watch how the device works ahead of time. If you walk into my OR not knowing how the primary device that we're supposed to use that day works, I might not be letting you do quite as much because it shows me you're not fully prepared to be the surgeon. You're sort of one step behind. If you show up ready to be the surgeon, you know how the equipment works, you know what you're doing. Guess what? Step in the surgeon seat. As long as I know you're safe. So showing up ready to take on that next step, even if your attending doesn't know that you're ready or think that you're ready, the quicker you are ready, the quicker you're going to be able to prove yourself and be able to start doing. And so that goes for all of the different surgeries you'll have the opportunity to do. So you're going to go do a LaForte. Sure do. There are probably great videos and that's probably hard to see, but I sure did read to LINZ before I went to go do my first LaForte. And then guess what? I got to do like more than half of it. It was phenomenal. I still remember it. I was a baby intern and it was so cool. I still think it's slightly magic. But all those little things, knowing which, so looking at your cases the day or two beforehand and trying to watch a few videos if you can, asking your upper levels for good resources. If you're a book person and you can put to LINZ together and make it 3D in your brain, wonderful. It's good for some cases. It's not as good for others. So AHL is another really good resource. And it is used to be free for residents. It's not anymore. I can't remember. I think it's like $25 or $50. Yeah. I think well worth it personally. I think most programs let you use book money for it. But finding out those resources, especially if you are going to be surgically inclined. Okay. So now that we've talked about the OR, which is inherently one of the more physically taxing locations we, you know, live in as a resident, how do you think about surviving and protecting your physical health and like physically taking care of yourself through working 80-hour work weeks, doing 24-hour calls, all of this new sort of high stress, physical stress for your body situations?
Yeah, it's really hard. And I say this as somebody who doesn't always follow these tips and tricks, but as much as you can, make sure you eat before your shift, bring snacks, know where the cafeteria is that's open late at night, because you're going to just burn out really quickly if you don't have anything to eat. Protect your feet. You're going to be on your feet a lot. So wear compression socks, get shoes, invest in shoes with like good arch support. I just threw out a pair of shoes that I had for 2 years because I realized my feet were getting so sore because I wore them out so, so thoroughly. I threw them out and I got new shoes, and it makes a huge difference because you're going to be standing in the OR forever. What
are some of the favorite ones? I'm still old school. I use Danskos. The main complaint for people is that they're heavy, and they are heavy, but I will tell you they're the only thing with enough arch support for my very flat feet. Have you used any other brands?
I've just bought some UFOs, OOFOS, and they're great. They have really good arch support. Yeah. Something else to protect in addition to your feet is your sleep. Make sure that when you're on nights, you have a place to go during the day where you know you can sleep pretty well, meaning like get some blinds, like blackout curtains, a white noise app or a fan. You want to make sure you're well rested on nights. You're already sleep deprived. And yeah, that's big thing.
I will say, as it wasn't until I was an intern that I realized how important my sleep was for every aspect of my life. I felt like, I think a couple months into it, I was just telling Dr. Brown before this podcast, I did one of my second rotation, I think, was an 8-week block of nights. And I was probably, I mean, I don't know how much sleep I was getting, but it was not adequate. And my memory started getting not good. My moods were obviously not good. I just felt like everything was falling apart a little bit more than I expected. And I got a Fitbit for the first time and it tracked my sleep. And I realized how impactful that sleep was. And I started making a bunch of changes in my sleep environment. And by the time I got it to the point, I was consistently getting over 6 hours. It's not a huge goal, but over 6 hours, everything started kind of normalizing and it felt so much better. But I feel like we are so used to ridiculous schedules and ridiculous hours, and it's very normalized in what we do. But having objective data for me to then feel like I could be selfish and prioritize my sleep over other obligations, other people, other things, and be like, no, I only got like 5 hours last night. I got to go to bed early tonight. It gave me what I felt like an excuse or objective data to actually prioritize my sleep in a way that was really helpful. And I think made a big difference in my learning and my performance. So figuring it out what it is that does that for you. For some people, it's like 3 square meals a day, 2 of them being super healthy. Great. For other people, the food thing can go as long as the sleep and exercise are there. For other people, it's simply the exercise. The other 2 falls in. Figure out what your things are that keep you going and keep going. All right. Let's then talk about how to stand out, like in a good way. What's going to make you make a really good first impression, not only to your co-residents, but to your attendings, to the nursing staff, to everybody else around you?
So early on, you're not going to, you know, be at the level of your chief, and that's totally okay. Don't try to compare yourself to your chief early on. Think of the small but impactful things that you can do on a daily basis. Be early. The earlier you are, the better you can mentally prepare for the day and make sure that your notes are well written and have a good assessment and plan, and that you actually have enough time to see your patients in the morning. Write clean, consistent notes that are easy to understand. It doesn't have to be super in-depth, but it just has to be clear enough that other people who read it understand what's going on with the patient. Know vitals and labs like stone cold, and know when vitals and labs are abnormal and when to escalate and to let your chief know. Other ways to stand out is making sure you follow on loose ends in the morning. Your chief often will assign tasks. So making sure this patient gets a unit of blood, making sure this patient ambulates today. You can follow up on that throughout the day. Message the nurse, check in on the patient later on the day. These are small things that don't require, you know, like a lot of experience. You're just like following up on tasks and being reliable.
And so figuring out what works for you in that sense, right? Like, I know I'm a paper girly. Like, I like to have my checklist written down on my patient list in front of me, tangible in my hands. That way I don't forget it. I make my little checky boxes and I check them all throughout the day. Other people use the handoff in Epic. Other people use other EMR things. Figuring out if your team has a preference, obviously differing to whatever that team preference is, as long as it works for you. But figuring out what your preferred workflow is for that sort of stuff, and not just taking the first thing somebody suggests to you, because we all work differently. We all have different brains. Whatever is going to make sure you follow through on those things as life gets more complicated.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. And then what are some first-year faux pas or mistakes to avoid?
Big ones are not escalating soon enough. If you're worried, I mean, I said this earlier, but make sure other people know that that something's wrong, or that you're worried that something's wrong. Double check your orders early on. Like, I would put in orders and then I'd be like, where did that order go? And it was like so frustrating, because it was felt like such a simple thing. I would put in like a CBC and it was supposed to be stat, but I accidentally just put it in for tomorrow morning. So just like double checking orders and recognizing how your EMR works early on. And then we're all very tired after our long days, especially on labor delivery, where you're up and you're running and you're doing vaginal deliveries. At the end of the day, you're going to be exhausted. Recognizing your limits, both like in medicine, like your knowledge limits, but also your emotional and your physical limits. And then what's contributing to those? Like, when you're like short with other people, you could try to recognize that and maybe reassess, like, did I get enough sleep last night? Did I eat today? How is my team dynamic?
Because all of those things at the end of the day will impact your mood as well as your job satisfaction. And if those two things both go down, it sucks. It's saving a little bit of time and a little bit of energy for self-reflection so you don't get in a terrible cycle.
Yeah. And then the last mistake that I definitely felt that I was guilty of was comparing myself to my seniors, seeing, you know, how smart they were and how good they were at signing out patients and how they just knew all these things off the top of their head, how good they were at surgery. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get there. I'm so bad. And it's just like, it's not worth worrying about, because you're not supposed to be at that level yet. And that's what residency is for.
And know that if the program got to help them get where they are, that it'll help you get where you need to go.
Yeah, that's good.
I think one other thing I want to briefly mention is mentorship, if I can.
Yeah.
So if I can just ask you a little bit about what to look for in mentors, not only like faculty wise, but in terms of like residents and fellows that have been like, because I think almost all programs have to have some type of formal mentorship, but they might not, or maybe your assigned mentor isn't a good fit. Yeah. But just kind of thinking about mentorship as something to carve out time for, and the importance of kind of finding that within your program for whatever else.
Yeah. I think we were really fortunate that we have assigned generalist mentors, which Dr. Dory is my generalist mentor, and that worked out really, really well for us. And then we also got assigned, our wellness chiefs assigned us chief mentors, and the mentor that I was assigned just was very, very helpful at giving me tips throughout the year. And she was somebody that I would reach out to on very difficult rotations to say, like, is this normal to feel this way? Is it normal that I'm like so, so bad at laparoscopy? And she would just be that reassuring presence, like, yes, this is normal. Like, it's okay. Like, this also happened to me. Like, the most comforting thing that I could hear was like, that happened to me too. Like, oh gosh, that's such a common lived experience. Like, it's not just you. And that was like, in terms of mentorship, was the most helpful aspect.
Yeah. Having people who could just kind of walk you through what the normal trajectory is and not mm-hmm. have it be your program director or somebody in like a position of power.
Right.
Because it can feel lonely. Like most of your rotations, you're going to be the sole intern. So you don't know if you're on track, if you're ahead, if you're behind, where you're at. A lot of the time, it feels very nebulous. So it's nice to have co-residents of different, different ages or stations that can kind of reflect with you and whatnot.
And validate, your worries. You're like, oh my gosh, like, this is the first time I manipulated a uterus. Like, why is this so hard? It's like, it is hard. It is really, it's not intuitive. It's
also some of the big uteruses. It's your arm workout for the day or week or month.
Yes.
I remember being so sore as an intern several days after like fighting very large fibroid uteruses and being like, oh my word, I played rugby. I didn't think this would be physically hard. Okay, so find your mentors early, find your people. We are entering a very specific kind of cult, if you will, in residency, and it is impossible, I think, for those outside of the cult to understand the things we do and why we do them. And while your partners, your family, your friends, I feel like are all good supports in many ways, they don't have the insider information to help guide you through some of the hard stuff. So it is nice to have somebody within the cult leading you through things.
Yes. And I'm telling you that it gets easier. It really does. And
I'll give you like the brief overview somebody gave me very early on, which was first year, you're a fluffy puppy and you're so excited that you can get through almost everything. Second year is a natural lull. A lot of people their second year hit their bottom. Whatever your rock bottom is going to be, it often comes during second year outside of any major life events or things like that. But second year, you tend to hit a little bit of a grind. You just have less energy built up from your fourth year of medical school when you got to rest and like be excited. Mm-hmm. And you're often dealing with like just harder things, like heavier things, if you will. You're dealing with more of the death. You're dealing with fetal death, neonatal death, oncology death. You're dealing with just tougher topics and have less of those beautiful, like normal vaginal delivery moments of intern year. Yeah. And so second year can be really hard. Third year, you're finally like, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm more than halfway done. I can do it. And then your chief year, you're like, let me get a job and get out of here. Or let me get into fellowship and get out of here.
Yeah.
But just to know that it gets better. Yeah. It does. We can all get through it. There might be some bumps along the road, but we will all get through it.
Yes.
The final thing that Dr. Brown and I put together is just a list of a bunch of resources for everybody. These are things that you can spend time before you start your intern year, or if you're listening to this partway through your intern year, make sure you have on your phone. A lot of these are going to be apps, or you can get them on desktop too, probably. But most of them are just like, most of us have a page of medical apps on our phones. UpToDate, ACOG. ACOG, the app, has all the practice bulletins in it. I also keep a lot of the practice bulletins in my Google Drive because Google Drive is my personal like organizational system for things. And I like to be able to search in there as well. Infant Risk, some type of like pregnancy and breastfeeding medication app. So Infant Risk or ReproTox are two of the biggest ones. ASCCP is your PAP and COLPO algorithm. CDC STI app is going to be for all your STI treatments. It is currently still looking pretty accurate. I can't guarantee in the next coming months. So please keep an eye on things. Make sure that if things look wonky, that you're backing it up at other sources, because some of these things are becoming a little bit more questionable. USMEC SPR is your contraception contraindications, again, from the CDC currently. So it is also being pulled to other websites and other places for corroboration and other evidence to be integrated because it's no longer being kept up to date, unfortunately. Some type of OB wheel or dating app on your pregnancy or pregnancy dating app on your phone. open evidence is really great for a quick, hey, I don't know the answer to this question. Let me find a couple good papers to go back and read. Again, I don't rely on it solely without going back to read some of the source articles because it can represent some things as all AI can. Yeah. USPSTF is good for preventive care, annuals, like your well woman stuff in the office. Some type of calculation app, UpToDate now has a lot of this built in, but you can also, another common one I think I have on my phone is MDCalc. I think Dr. Brown said she uses this one a lot too. Cancer things, thankfully, I no longer really keep these on my phone, but they're helpful in residency. So NCCN and FIGO for staging. And then for your Eurogyne rotation, the PopQ app has nice visuals for when you're putting in your PopQs and like to be able to visualize what the exam is going to look like and make sure that it corroborates with what you actually saw if you had already done the exam and you're just reporting it out. But you can kind of practice putting in different numbers for the exams and seeing what it would actually look like, which is helpful. I'm sure there's lots more, but we'll put a bunch on the show notes from the podcast today. And you guys can check them out and then leave us comments and notes about what other resources you guys think are key. I guess I'll mention a few other podcasts since we're here. CREOGS Over Coffee when you're studying for your CREOGS. And then MedReady Suite has a bunch of stuff that more aimed at medical students, but sometimes is useful to interns as well. And those are sort of the big ones within the OB residency space.
Thanks for listening to Intern Ready OBGYN. We hope you found today's podcast helpful. Don't forget to subscribe below, rate the podcast, leave a review, or suggest a new episode.